When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, giving a chat about the Gallipoli campaign, a military operation that took place early on during the First World War when the Allied powers launched an invasion of the Ottoman Empire in seeking to seize control of the Turkish Straits. And the Gallipoli campaign has gone on to have particular significance here in Australia and also across the ditch in Aotearoa, New Zealand, because of the involvement of our troops from our, what were very young nations at the time, troops that have become known as the Anzacs. Every year on the 25th of April, Anzac Day is celebrated by Aussies and Kiwis, a solemn memorialisation of the young men who sailed to fight on behalf of Australia, New Zealand and the British Empire as the First World War continued. Most Australians I know have some sort of an idea about Gallipoli and the role that we played in it, and I imagine that's the case for many Kiwis, given how important and prominent Anzac Day is in both of our national calendars. But what actually happened during the Gallipoli campaign? You might know that it was an abject failure, so why then do we celebrate it? Well, there is plenty to discover and learn about when it comes to Gallipoli. For instance, you might not have known that the Anzacs, the Aussies and the Kiwis fighting in Gallipoli, formed only a very small fraction of the Allied troops over there. I didn't know that until I was researching this episode. Based on what I'd picked up over the years as just a, you know, everyday average Australian, I thought it was only Anzacs fighting there. But as we'll talk about, that was not the case at all. But as I mentioned, the campaign was a failure for the Allies. Thousands upon thousands of lives were lost in Gallipoli, both Allies and Ottomans. And in the end, this all amounted to more or less nothing. A senseless waste of life, young life, tragically young life, eager young men who piled onto ships over here to fight for king and empire over there, seeking glory and excitement and adventure. And instead, they met only disease, destruction, and death as the horrors of trench warfare saw thousands die at the wrong end of Ottoman machine guns. Today, we're going to talk about the campaign, how and why it was staged, what happened as it unfolded, what went wrong, and ultimately why it failed. And we'll also talk about the lasting legacy of the Gallipoli campaign, especially here in Australia and New Zealand, and the role that Anzac Day plays right through to this very day in modern day society. Anzac Day is coming up in a few days, so I thought this was a good time to get across Gallipoli as a topic. And I'll note that today's episode is more specifically focused on the role that Aussie and Kiwi soldiers played in the Gallipoli campaign rather than the campaign as a whole, because a lot of listeners are keen to hear about exactly this, the Anzacs in Gallipoli. This is one of the most requested topics that comes into my inbox. And so thanks go to alert listeners, Reese Murdoch, Calvin Jameson, Andrew Lawrence, Lachlan McIver, Jasper Pickering, Hamish Nelson, Sharon Ann, Liam Rigdon, Travis Weatherly, Michael Hardwick, Brett Hasler, Kai Maliska, and Hayden Bosgra. As I say, a lot of listeners wanting to get across this. So let's get into it here. Let's get underway with the story of the Gallipoli campaign and the role that the Anzacs played in it. Here we go. We're going all the way back here. We're going all the way back to 1914, as despite the Gallipoli campaign itself kicking off in 1915, the whole reason it happened in the first place was due to some, reasonably important events that took place the year before in 1914, namely the outbreak of the First World War, the Great War, as it was known, the War to End All Wars, which certainly didn't end up being a very accurate appellation. This war began in the wake of the assassination of Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand, episode 13, get across it. This assassination set a match to the political powder keg that was Europe at the time, and Europe very enthusiastically went to war, split into two major factions. On one side, there were the Allied powers. Major nations included Britain, France, Russia, and when they, finally decided to show up, the United States as well. And on the other side, the Central powers. This included Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, other nations as well. And one very small note here before the story continues. People have a bit of a bad habit of conflating the overarching, teams or themes, if you like, of the Second World War with the First. And this results in the Central powers of the First World War, specifically Germany, being considered the bad guy during this conflict, during the First World War, in the same way that they were most certainly and definitely the bad guy during the Second World War. There is, of course, no denying how horrifically despicable and monstrous Nazi Germany was. They were nothing but, to put it in very simple terms, the bad guys in the Second World War. But the Germans weren't really the bad guys in the First World War any more than any other nation was. We tend to think that they were because, they were in the Second, and also because we fought them and won, and therefore they must be the bad guys, right? Especially as we won, right? But no, not really. In the First World War, Germany and the Central Powers were no better or worse, morally speaking, than the Allied powers, really. While the Second World War was a fight against the evils of Nazism and fascism and everything else that characterized Nazi Germany, the First World War was much less black and white, and I don't think it's fair or indeed accurate to call one side good and the other evil. Having said all that, however, as I am an English-speaking Australian, as I'm a product of a nation and culture dominated by the British and British history, there's no doubt that this show will have a significant bias towards the Allied powers and also very deliberately focused, as I already mentioned, on the Australia and New Zealand Army Corps. So that will be the lens through which we examine Gallipoli, and that comes with its own set of biases, which, are important. These biases are important to keep in mind when talking about any historical issue, but this one in particular, I'm trying to lay them bare so you understand where I'm coming from. Anyway, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, he was shot by Gavrilo Princip in Sarajevo on the 28th of June 1914, and if that hadn't started the First World War, then the next political crisis would have. Austria-Hungary cracked down on Serbia, Russia came to Serbia's defence, Germany jumped in to support Austria-Hungary and invaded France for good measure, via Belgium, which then saw Britain get stuck in, and so by early August, the First World War was well and truly underway. In late October 1914, the Ottomans, who, as I mentioned, entered the war on the side of Germany and Austria-Hungary as one of the central powers, they began to attack Russian maritime interests in the Black Sea, north of today's Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, of course, being the precursor state to modern Turkey. But the Black Sea, it is connected to the Mediterranean by a series of narrow waterways known as the Turkish Straits. Going from the Mediterranean into the Black Sea, you have to pass through a narrow strait known as the Dardanelles into the sea, the small Sea of Marmara, and then through the even narrower Bosporus Strait, which runs directly through the city of Istanbul, or Constantinople as it was known back then. And without getting into the deeply complex and convoluted politics of the Dardanelles, the Bosporus, and the Ottoman Empire's roles in international shipping between the Mediterranean and the Black Seas, I'll say this. The Ottomans entering the war on the side of the Central Powers and attacking Russian shipping in the Black Sea was a disaster for the Allied powers. Because without access to the Black Sea, the Western Allies had no way to materially support their allies in Russia. Germany had the Baltic Sea blockaded, the Arctic Ocean was icy and impenetrable, they couldn't, walk to Russia because Germany and Austria-Hungary were in the way. So without being able to sail through the Dardanelles and the Bosporus, Russia was cut off from its Western allies. And this, to put it mildly, was not an ideal situation for the Allies. And so as the Ottomans entered the war, the Allies began to come up with plans to reopen the Dardanelles and the Bosporus to Allied shipping. They tried diplomacy. They tried bribes. They tried coastal bombardments. They tried sailing in a fleet of battleships to attack the Ottoman defences along the Dardanelles. But none of this worked. And the battleship attack in particular was a bit of a disaster, as the Ottomans had filled the straits full of sea mines, so no one could sail through safely. Allied minesweepers couldn't clear the straits due to Ottoman artillery emplacements on the shores. Allied battleships couldn't effectively attack the artillery because it was mobile artillery. And generally speaking, the Allies weren't making an inch of progress up the Dardanelles, and so the Allied powers decided on a different approach to reopen this strait to their shipping, namely a land invasion. So infantry could go off and attack and clear the Ottoman artillery that lined the Dardanelles Strait. So the minesweepers could then clear the straits, so Allied battleships could then sail through and force the reopening of shipping to the Black Sea, so Russia could receive support and supplies from the West. And the point chosen to stage this land invasion of the Dardanelles was, of course, the Gallipoli Peninsula, on the northern side of the Dardanelles, where the Allies expected to be able to carry off a landing with minimal Ottoman resistance. And, of course, what happened was very, very different. The Ottoman resistance was anything but minimal, as we will come to in due course. But before we get there, let's talk about who exactly would be staging this landing in Gallipoli. After the outbreak of the First World War, and specifically after Britain entered the conflict, it wasn't long before British colonies around the world were being dragged into the war as well. Well, I say dragged, that doesn't quite capture it really, because most young men in places like Australia, Aotearoa New Zealand, Canada and other parts of the British Empire were just all too keen to go off and fight for king and empire. In late 1914, thousands of enthusiastic young men signed up to fight alongside the British in places like Australia and New Zealand. They still consider themselves to be British in a very real sense, less so than Aussies or Kiwis. And as a result, they thought it not only honourable and morally correct, but they also thought it'd be exciting. It'd be the adventure of a lifetime, going off and seeking glory, fighting, as I say, for the British Empire. And so the recruitment officers were overwhelmed with young men eager to sail halfway around the world and give those blasted bloody Huns a taste of red-hot Aussie and Kiwi fury. Many of these young men, they lied about their ages too. They weren't young men, they were little more than boys. They were teenagers, all desperate for a chance to prove their courage and bravery by going off to war. And as these recruits were made ready to sail for Europe, a name was given to this newly created army of volunteers, the Australasian Army Corps. Now, this made sense. Back then, both Aussies and Kiwis used to compete on the same team in international sporting events as Australasia, and so the Australasian Army Corps was thought to be a fitting name for this cohort of men. But no, the Kiwis started to whinge. Oh, what's that? What are we calling? Oh, that's not fair. They're bloody taking the piss again. We're getting overlooked once more. Oh, everyone forgets about us. Although, I mean, look, that maybe they've got a point there. Aotearoa is so forgotten about that it's sometimes left off of world maps, tucked as it is down in the corner there. So I don't know, maybe the Kiwis had a point with their whinging. In any case, their carrying on meant that the name of the corps was changed. It was changed to the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. But then, this is not a gag, I'm not making this bit up or exaggerating it, right? Army clerks got so sick of writing that entire name out, the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, they got so sick of writing that out on forms or in documentation or whatever else, that they adopted the shortcut ANZAC, right? A-N-Z-A-C, and the name stuck. And that is how we ended up with the term ANZAC. And it's not just an initialism now. It's a noun. You can talk about an ANZAC or the ANZACs. It's defined in dictionaries as a proper noun. Anyway, The original plan for the Anzacs was to send them over to England for training before their deployment in the war itself. But as our boys were sailing over towards Europe, there was a bit of a change of plan. Check this out. The Canadian Expeditionary Force, the Kanakistani version of the Anzacs, right? They'd just done this. They'd sailed over for training in England and had an absolutely miserable time in England as they were being trained up. Cold, wet, not enough supplies, accommodation or equipment. The poor Canadians, imagine Canadians complaining about the cold. It must have been terrible. They were put through the ringer before they even arrived on the Western Front. And so the British authorities decided, therefore, to send the Anzacs not to Britain, like they had done with the poor old Canadians, but instead send them to Egypt, which was under British control, for training there. Very wise indeed. Maybe the Kiwis would have been able to cope with the British winter, but the Aussies, oh, mate, we would have struggled, I'll tell you that. I know I did while living over in the UK. Bloody miserable it was. Certainly wouldn't have made me keen to fight for King and Empire, I tell you that. I would have said, oh, bugger this for a joke. Too cold, too wet, too miserable. These German buggers can have the place that they want. Get me back to sunny Queensland, mate. Anyway, the Anzacs, they were sent to Egypt for training. And while they were there that these plans for a land-based invasion of the Dardanelles were being drawn up. And who better to stage this invasion than the courageous, brave, and, from the point of view of the British, highly expendable young men from those grotty old colonies half a world away. Although I will say, I'm not actually being 100% accurate here. I should clarify a few things to avoid supporting some pretty common misconceptions that I mentioned I was labouring under before I properly researched this episode. Almost 500,000 Allied soldiers took part in the Gallipoli campaign across 1915. And of that number, again, almost 500,000, nearly 500,000 troops all told, only 65,000 or so were Anzacs. These days, Aussies and Kiwis have sort of taken ownership of the Allied side of the Gallipoli campaign, and I don't think it's that big a mistake to make to think that it was just us there, just the Aussies and the Kiwis, no British or French or any other allies. But that was not the case, not even close. The overwhelming majority of the Allied forces in Gallipoli were British, and there were more Frenchmen there than there were Aussies and Kiwis combined. In fact, the total number of Anzacs in Gallipoli was smaller than the total number of British casualties in Gallipoli. So, in all honesty, we played a pretty small role in the grand scheme of things. But, as we'll talk about later on, this event was a much bigger deal for us as young nations with small populations still coming to grips with our own nationhoods than it was for the British or the French with much larger populations and expansive national histories. And that's not to mention that for the Allies overall, the Gallipoli campaign was just one small aspect of the First World War from a much larger picture, right? Whereas for us, for the Anzacs, this was our First World War, to begin with at least. Anyway, all these poor young bastards getting ready for the invasion, they were not prepared for what lay in wait for them on the Gallipoli Peninsula. The British authorities assured them that the Ottomans were all irredeemable cowards to a man, and that the Ottomans were all enormously underprepared for what was certain to be a crushingly successful invasion. The moment the Ottomans heard the roar of the Allied guns, they'd be turning and running with their tails between their legs. The British greatly underestimated the Ottomans, who they considered to be in decline, in poor form. They'd lost the recent Italo-Turkish War. They were plagued with internal issues. But the Allies were foolish to think that the Ottomans wouldn't hold their own in Gallipoli, as while the Anzacs were preparing for deployment, preparations that suffered significant delays, the Turks had bolstered the Dardanelles, they had reinforced their defences on land and on sea, and they were well and truly ready to handle any potential invasion. In particular, the month or so by which the Allies were delayed in mobilising for Gallipoli was instrumental in the Ottomans and their German allies having enough time to properly prepare for a full-scale invasion. They built roads, they dug trenches, they strung barbed wire across entire stretches of beach, and they set up heavy artillery in key positions along the peninsula to defend not just a potential beach landing on one side of the peninsula, but also to continue to defend the Dardanelles Strait itself on the other side of the peninsula, the whole reason that the Allies were going to attack in the first place. And so by the end of April, when the attack finally came, the Ottomans were well and truly ready to defend themselves on their home turf, which obviously had terrible consequences for our boys sent over there. The Allies finally planned to land on Gallipoli on the 23rd of April, but even this was delayed. The weather took a turn for the worse, and so at long last, the Anzacs were sent off to land on the beaches at Gallipoli on the 25th of April, 1915, a date that we commemorate to this very day, Anzac Day, of course. A number of different beaches were identified as landing locations for the Allies, but there's one in particular we're going to talk about as we focus in now on the Anzacs and their experience of war in Gallipoli. And this beach was located in a cove that is now known as Anzac Cove, because that is where our poor young buggers from half a world away were sent in to land and to fight and to die as the invasion got underway. Around 25,000 men, mostly Aussies and Kiwis, but some British and Indian troops amongst them, were tasked with landing at this cove and in order to make their way on shore, cut through the Ottoman lines, disrupt their communication, and establish positions on the high ground in order to facilitate further advances towards the strait itself on the other side of the peninsula. They were transported to the cove in the early hours of the morning on the 25th of April aboard British warships, and at around 4 o'clock, troops began to make their way ashore aboard smaller boats. And after actually making landfall, these poor boys had a terrible time of it, trying to get across the beach and up towards the Ottoman lines. The cove wasn't hugely strongly defended. There were only a few contingents of Ottoman troops, but the defences that were in place tore through the Anzacs as they made it ashore. As the Anzacs scrambled onto and then across the beach, Ottoman defensive emplacements were able to fire freely on the approaching troops from a raised position above the beach itself. And from the beach, after landing, the landscape quickly rose up with rocks and shrubs providing natural obstacles, in addition to the artificial obstacles that had been placed there by the Turks. And so as they attempted to make it ashore, Anzacs in their hundreds were cut down by Ottoman gunfire. More and more waves of Anzacs landed, but their progress up the steep banks beyond the beaches was very slow, and more bodies piled up as the Ottomans continued to fire on them, in the boats, on the beaches, and then further inland. But all the same, through sheer force of numbers, the Anzacs began to make progress across the beach, up the steep and uneven terrain, and onto the plateau that the Ottomans were using to fire. And there, the fighting began in earnest, and the Anzacs were able to drive the Ottomans back from their defensive emplacements and establish themselves on this plateau. But here's the thing. The plateau wasn't their objective. Their objective was far further inland, and they had absolutely no chance of making it there. The Ottomans had withdrawn and consolidated themselves on this high ground further inland, and far from being the cowards that the Allies had said they would be, the Ottomans stood their ground. They fiercely fought off any and all attacks that the Anzacs mounted, defending their homeland and their country from these invaders. So, instead of the expansive territorial gains that the Allies had expected, the Anzacs instead managed to secure only a very small strip of coastline around Anzac Cove, around 2 kilometres long, and 1 kilometre deep. And this had come at the cost of 2,000 casualties all within a single day, and the small sliver of beach that the Anzacs had captured at such a high price was already littered with the bodies of the dead and the wounded. And because the Anzacs hadn't been able to penetrate the Ottoman lines and cut off their communications as planned, the Ottomans were able to dig in and defend themselves on the high ground in their trenches, only a short distance inland. And as a result, The Anzacs had no choice but to do the same. The invasion had very quickly become a stalemate as the Anzacs dug in around Anzac Cove as well.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's essentially no limit to how deep we could go on the Gallipoli campaign. It could very easily be an entire podcast series on its own. We have very detailed accounts of the campaign on all levels, from the soldiers fighting it to the commanders calling the shots on both sides. But in the interests of keeping this podcast to a listenable and digestible length, I'll stick to the main points, the overarching story of the campaigns, focusing once again on the experience of the Anzacs in particular, and then we will get into why and how this campaign ended up being a failure. The Anzacs weren't the only allies dug in on the Gallipoli Peninsula, of course. In the days after the landing on the 25th, further Allied troops were brought in to strengthen the Allied footholds that had been made so far up and down the peninsula. However, the Ottomans also called in reinforcements, knowing now exactly where they had to defend rather than being spread more thinly across the entire peninsula before the landings. And as a result, Gallipoli as a whole remained something of a stalemate. Allied attacks were launched against the Ottomans, costing thousands of lives and gaining very little materially. The Ottomans, however, they were also unable to roundly defeat the Allied invaders, who had in the end almost 500,000 troops involved in this campaign, as I mentioned. The Allies outnumbered the Ottomans from go to woe, but all the same, neither side was able to gain much of an advantage over the other as April turned to May and the campaign continued. As for the Anzacs specifically, they staged several attacks, aided by Allied artillery support, on the Ottoman lines around Anzac Cove. But once again, this proved both highly ineffective and also devastatingly costly. The Ottomans had strongly secured themselves in their trenches on high ground raised above the Allied position, and machine gun emplacements were able to hold off any and all Anzac advances. Thousands and thousands of young Aussies and Kiwis died as they followed the orders they'd been given to jump up out of the trenches and advance to charge the Ottomans and seek to make territorial gains, and instead were cut down mercilessly by Ottoman machine gun fire. The advantage was firmly with the Ottomans. They were on home turf. They had a much easier time with supplies and logistics and reinforcements and communication, while the Allies had to constantly resupply their troops from the sea, which was not very easy considering that there weren't any ports for them to use along the Gallipoli Peninsula. In mid-May, the Allies were running low on ammunition. The stalemate hadn't got either side anywhere. So if the Ottomans just did nothing but sit and defend their territory, they knew that they'd just kind of win by default. So it was up to the Allies, therefore, to push forward. But they couldn't find a way to do it, as many of the plans they'd made had been scuppered by the unexpected fierceness of the Ottoman resistance, and also, as it turns out, the faulty military intelligence that had been used to plan this invasion out. The Allies didn't have accurate maps of the area. They didn't have an understanding of the role of the terrain would play in this invasion. They'd thought that they would be able to land troops, march forward, capture the peninsula, and therefore mount an attack on the strait on the other side of the peninsula and get their ships through the Dardanelles, no worries. And this was not the case. They ran into all sorts of logistical issues. For instance, almost 6,000 horses were waiting on Allied ships at sea for a place that they could be safely landed and put to use as cavalry. But this never came to be because there was nowhere that the horses could land. There was nowhere to land them safely, and even if they could land, there was nowhere that had enough water for the horses to drink. And so in the end, the ships that were carrying these nearly 6,000 horses were turned around and sent back to Egypt, the horses never setting foot, or never setting hoof, I guess, on Gallipoli. So the stalemate continued up and down the peninsula, but when it comes to Anzac Cove specifically, that changed on the 19th of May, when the Ottomans staged their largest counterattack yet on Anzac Cove to try to end the Aussie and Kiwi occupation there for good. And this attack became known to history as the Third Attack on Anzac Cove. Almost 50,000 Ottomans mobilized to attack the 17,000 Anzacs at the Cove. And this huge force of Ottomans was roundly defeated by our boys, as once again the advantages held by the defenders in trench warfare were insurmountable. Allied recon had spotted the Ottomans preparing this attack, and so the Anzacs made preparations and were ready for it. During the attack, the Ottomans lost 3,000 troops, while the Anzacs lost a total of 160. And one of those dead, very sadly, was a young Australian bloke named John Simpson Kirkpatrick. You might have heard of Simpson and his donkey, a very famous part of the Anzac story, someone that we might have to get across in greater detail at some point, I reckon. However, this was such an overwhelming defeat for the Ottomans that they thought twice before attempting to drive back the invaders off the peninsula and into the sea, again, realizing that all they had to do effectively was nothing, and they would kind of win by default as long as they could hold their ground. In fact, after the third attack on Anzac Cove, a truce was arranged between the Anzacs and the Ottomans so both sides could gather and bury their dead that were strewn across the no man's land between the two sets of trenches. And reportedly, Aussie, Kiwi and Turkish soldiers all mingled during this truce, chatting and exchanging gifts, like during the Christmas truce of 1914, Quarter Hour's History, episode 37, get across it. But into June, the stalemate continued, both in Anzac Cove and elsewhere. The horrific, brutal reality of trench warfare was that you simply could not advance into an occupied position, and thousands would have to die in order to gain just a few metres of ground. The Allies kept up a strong presence at sea, while the Ottomans continued to fortify their positions by land, and so the campaign dragged on without either side being able to make any progress. And what's worse, the conditions endured by the soldiers fighting up and down the peninsula, on both sides, on trenches on both sides, the Ottomans and the Allies, up and down the Gallipoli Peninsula, but particularly, as we focus once again on Anzac Cove, the conditions were horrendous for our boys over there. It was a baking hot, stinking hot Turkish summer, and many of the poor souls who had gone up over the trenches into no man's land and been shot down, their corpses had just been left to rot in the sun. There was no comfort for the poor boys fighting in these trenches. Disease was rife. There were flies that treated these corpses as breeding grounds. It was a living hell for the poor troops fighting in these trenches. But the Anzacs in particular gained a bit of a reputation for their good-humoured approach to enduring this hardship, for the way that they looked after themselves and each other, and were noted for somehow maintaining a positive atmosphere, an atmosphere of camaraderie and enthusiasm and general good feelings, despite, as I say, these horrific conditions that they were being subjected to. The Colonials, as they were called, were known to be a hardy and tough bunch, a group of men who were weathering the storm as best they could and were always ready to follow the orders that were handed down from on high, despite the fact that these orders were, in many cases, verging on suicidal for these poor blokes. Because with the Allies still failing to take decisive control of the strait, in August it was decided that another big push would be made to secure the high ground of the Gallipoli Peninsula and thereby unlock the strait by overpowering the Ottoman forces on the peninsula's other side. In early August, the Allied forces in Gallipoli, including the Anzacs, were ordered to advance. And I tell you what, our boys got very bloody close. Some Aussies, for instance, managed to mount a quite successful attack on the Ottoman emplacements before they were forced to withdraw when the Allied artillery bombardment supporting them ended prematurely. But most notable of all, however, was the Kiwi infantry units that got within half a kilometre of the objective that they'd been ordered to seize, the peak of Chunuk Bear, some strategically important high ground. These Kiwis dug in and held their position for 3 days against the Ottoman counterattack, but then finally were forced to retreat when a huge number of casualties were taken after the Ottomans counterattack once and for all and retook Chunuk Bear. The Battle of Chunuk Bear was probably the closest the Allies ever came to victory in Gallipoli, thanks to the Kiwis. But after the Ottomans reclaimed it, the fortunes of the Allies only got worse from there. More reinforcements were sent in, and then in late August there was one final push to seize the critical high ground across the peninsula by the Allies. The Anzacs were ordered to push forward and try to link up with other Allied forces nearby, combining the two together. But again, they couldn't make any gains against the Ottomans, who repelled this one last Allied offensive. And after the failed attacks in August, the Gallipoli campaign was effectively over. The Allies were forced to recognise the campaign had been a failure, especially after Bulgaria entered the war on the side of the Central Powers in September. With this, the Allies knew it would only get worse, as it would make it even easier for the Germans to supply their Ottoman allies. And indeed, heavy German artillery began to roll into Gallipoli, which would in time be able to annihilate the Allied forces there altogether. Additionally, the Allied Serbian campaign was going disastrously, which caused troops to be pulled out of Gallipoli to reinforce the Allied forces in the Balkans. And so eventually, in October and November 1915, Allied discussions about the abandonment of the Gallipoli campaign and the evacuation of the troops there finally resulted in evacuation plans getting underway in early December. Months and months of fruitless and deadly stalemate was finally coming to an end. The poor soldiers who had survived the ordeal so far would at last be given respite from their suffering in the trenches. The conditions for these poor blokes had gone from bad to worse. It had gone from burning hot to freezing cold now that winter had come. The countless thousands of dead bodies were still a breeding ground for flies that made something as simple as eating almost impossible, and diseases like dysentery and typhoid fever were ravaging the poor blokes in the trenches up and down the peninsula, so you can only imagine the relief they must have felt when they found out that the evacuation was getting underway. Once the order came to evacuate Gallipoli, the Allies slowly trickled troops out of the area, preparing for one last major evacuation when the right time came. And for the Anzacs, at least, I'm very happy to tell you that the evacuation was a total and unmitigated success. Really, it's the only part of the whole operation that actually went well for our poor boys. Not a single one of them lost their lives as they quickly retreated onto the ships on the night of the 19th and 20th of December. Now, they had a few tricks up their sleeve in pulling off this evacuation as safely as they did. A young Australian fellow by the name of William Scurry invented a mechanism that made rifles fire themselves automatically. His ingenious device used two empty tins, one dripping water into the other, with the second tin attached to the trigger of the rifle. When the tin filled with water, it pulled on the trigger, firing the rifle, which made it seem like there were still active soldiers keeping an eye on a particular area. The Anzacs set up these drip rifles all around the place to make the Ottomans think that they were still there keeping watch, as in reality they all snuck away in the night and were evacuated safely. So, happily, the Anzacs made it out of Anzac Cove without the loss of any further life. But, of course, there were still thousands upon thousands of young men who never boarded the evacuation ships. Almost 9,000 Australians and almost 3,500 Kiwis never left Gallipoli, killed and left behind thousands upon thousands of kilometres from home. These brave, foolish boys who set off to war for adventure and excitement and glory, who left the grasslands and the gum trees of Australia, all the mountains and the Manuka of Aotearoa behind, not knowing that they would never, ever return. These poor souls travelled halfway across the world to die for a king they'd never met, for an empire that didn't know that they existed. And their bones remain there today, a vast distance from the lands that they once called home, resting under unfamiliar stars. The remaining Anzacs were sent back to Egypt, and then they were split up. The Kiwis went off to become the New Zealand Division and fought on the Western Front, including in the Battle of the Somme in 1916. The Australians, on the other hand, were reorganised as the Australian Imperial Force, and they fought just about everywhere, on the Western Front, in the Levant, in the Middle East, in Northern Africa, everywhere. The AIF became known for its hardy and tough soldiers, nicknamed the Diggers, and this is a nickname that we still use today to describe Australian troops. But even today, debate rages on about the Gallipoli campaign as a whole. What went wrong? What should have been done instead? How necessary it was in the first place? Because the Allies never managed to seize the Turkish Straits. It was intensely studied by military strategists in the future and strongly influenced other amphibious operations like, for instance, the D-Day landings in Normandy during the Second World War. So let's examine it ourselves here and talk about what went wrong. Why did the Gallipoli campaign fail? Well, there are four specific reasons we can talk about here. Firstly, number one, the Allied commanding authorities did a pretty bloody bad job when it came to planning and organising this campaign. They vastly underestimated the Ottomans and their defensive capabilities, making decisions on faulty or incomplete intelligence about their foes. But it went further than that. As I mentioned before, they didn't properly scout out or research the terrain that they'd be fighting on. They didn't have accurate maps. They didn't fully understand what they were committing to materially in attacking Gallipoli. Secondly, the Allies were also plagued with logistic and communication issues from go to woe, from the initial delays of the campaign to trying to supply and maintain multiple landing sites by sea, from lacking critical infrastructure to support the campaign. They had no ports, they had no roads, they didn't have clear lines of communication, the various Allied encampments weren't coordinated with one another, and so instead of rigidly planned, tightly organised and deftly executed manoeuvres, the Gallipoli campaign was chaotic, it was disjointed, the left hand didn't know what the right was doing as far as the Allies were concerned. Thirdly, the conditions for the Allied troops after they landed and dug in were, as I've said, absolutely awful. A baking hot summer into a freezing cold winter, dead bodies remaining uncleared from battlefield, meant flies and disease ravaged the camps. Dysentery, typhoid fever, these poor soldiers were experiencing the misery of trench warfare in the worst possible way. And losing men to disease as well as Ottoman machine guns didn't do anything to help the success of the campaign. And fourthly, if that's a word, and finally, the Ottomans did a really, really good job of defending themselves from invasion. They made some pretty horrendous errors too. The third attack on Anzac Cove springs to mind, as we mentioned. But overall, the Ottomans were much, much more effective at defending their homeland than the Allies had ever expected. They established themselves in well-defended, strongly fortified positions across the peninsula. They never gave the Allies an inch. They made use of the steep, unforgiving terrain to punish enemy advances, with their home ground advantage and their motivation to defend their homeland aiding them in ultimately forcing the invaders to pack up and leave after their failed campaign. I'll say this too, the Gallipoli campaign became a very important chapter in Turkish history as well, as one of the main Ottoman commanders in Gallipoli was a bloke named Mustafa Kemal, who went on to become known as Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder and first president of the post-war Republic of Turkey. Atatürk made his name in Gallipoli as a victorious commander and went on to become one of the most important figures in 20th century Turkish history. But his is another tale, and the role that Gallipoli played in Turkish history is a story for another time, because it's now time for us to examine instead the role that Gallipoli has played and still plays in the histories of Australia and Aotearoa New Zealand as an immensely important and, according to many, foundational chapter in the stories of our young nations. I mentioned before, in the grand scheme of things, the Gallipoli campaign only represented a small part of the overall Allied war effort. But for us, here on the other side of the world, with Australia just a decade and a half on from its official birth as a nation, with New Zealand established as a dominion of Britain in 1907, this was the first time that we had participated in world affairs as our own nations. Gallipoli and the Anzacs are often said to represent the birth of both our respective nationhoods. You'll often hear that our national identities only came into being thanks to this conflict. But I'm not sure how true that is. It will sometimes go even further than that. Here in Australia, at least, we get people speaking up about how our Australian values were established and founded in Gallipoli, how this campaign defined what it is to be an Australian. And I certainly don't agree with that. I think Australia and being Australian is a lot more than just the role that we as a nation played in the First World War. But all the same, you cannot hope to deny that the Gallipoli campaign and our involvement in it was a huge part of the histories of our young nations, even if it was little more than a footnote for the histories of many other Allied powers. The Anzacs were widely reported to have fought with bravery, their inexperience in war offset by their determination, their resourcefulness, their egalitarianism, their positivity, and their endurance of impossible hardship. But their deaths, their needless, senseless, tragic deaths, young men thrown to the Ottoman machine guns as expendable, replaceable military resources, their deaths shouldn't really be used to offer idealized affirmations of what makes our nations what they are. Every year, on the 25th of April, Anzac Day is celebrated as a public holiday in both Australia and Aotearoa New Zealand, and examining the memorialization of the historical Gallipoli campaign through the lens of today's Anzac Days is a very interesting thing to do. Now, I do want to say that I don't have any experience of how the Anzacs are invoked in New Zealand. I can't really talk about how it is on the other side of the Tasman, and instead I'll have to just mainly talk about Anzac Day in Australia. But here in Australia, the Gallipoli campaign is, as I say, memorialised every year as an event that forged our nationhood, that united our young country, that demonstrated the characteristics that make us uniquely Australian. But let's think about that for a little bit, because we were a nation long before Gallipoli, on paper even. We were anything but united on going to war, rejecting not one but two plebiscites on conscription. And as for the Anzac spirit being uniquely Australian, as it's so often touted in this country as being, what about the NZ part of Anzac? What about the Kiwis and their Anzacs? And for that matter, what about every other group of young and foolishly brave men who have gone off to fight and die for a cause across the vast sweep of history? I'm not saying we shouldn't admire the Anzacs and the characteristics and qualities they put on display in Gallipoli, but they're hardly uniquely Australian for doing so. Anzac spirit is often invoked to define our Australianness, to talk about what exclusively makes us the people we are. But this not only isn't true, it's also a very narrow view to take of this country and its people. What about the tens of thousands of years of Indigenous history that this continent has witnessed before Europeans came along? What about the suffering of uncountable convicts who were sent here against their will? What about the generations of immigrants who have come to this country and enriched and broadened its identity and character? What about Australian women, completely absent from the Anzac mythology? This supposedly foundational aspect of our history, something that is said to represent us, to define us as a nation, completely overlooks at the barest minimum the existence of one entire half of our population. I am not trying to minimize the suffering, the trials, the tribulations of those diggers who went over to fight and die in Gallipoli. Those poor young men exhibited bravery and courage in the worst of circumstances. They made the best of the situation they were in. They looked after each other. They did what they thought was right. And we are right to remember and solemnly memorialize those poor victims of one of the deadliest wars in human history. But every April, when Anzac Day comes around, and I see the way that it's almost weaponized by people 100 years on, weaponized to restrict and control and gatekeep Australianness with this idealized view of what was, when all is said and done, a horrific, destructive and deadly war, a war we fought in on behalf of another nation entirely, and not in a heroic crusade against evil like in the Second World War, a war fought for the nationalist, imperialist, and militaristic objectives of European powers half a world away. Anzac Day should not be allowed to be co-opted by people seeking to decide what it is and what it is not to be Australian. We are not a militaristic nation. We are not a nation that glorifies the armed forces. We're not a war-loving nation. We're not a nation built upon the celebration of violence or great and glorious battles and war. Again, I am not taking anything away from what our boys did in Gallipoli. I'm not taking away from the characteristics they show that are worthy of celebration, that do reflect admirably on Australia and Australians. We are an egalitarian people. We do look after each other. We do face adversity with determination and good humour. And these elements of the mythology of the Anzacs is rightfully celebrated each year. But we are also so much more than pawns sent off to die by imperial overlords. We are so much more than a century-old conflict that we fought on the behalf of others. We are a rich and a diverse nation, the lucky country with so much to be proud of and so much still to work on. And our character and our identity is not determined by a century-old conflict that results in an extremely narrow definition of Australianness. The Anzacs in Gallipoli wrote a critically important chapter of Australian history in 1915, a chapter written in the spilled blood of young men sent off to die in the service of imperial overlords. Lest we forget, indeed, lest we forget, we should not forget this tragic chapter of our history, from the terrible suffering and death to the laudable qualities that our boys put on display to the wider world. But nor should we forget that there is so much more that makes this nation what it is, and there is so much more for us to memorialise and honour and mourn and celebrate. So, this Anzac Day, remember and think about the tragic loss of life suffered by those young Aussies and Kiwis who left their homes behind to die in a foreign land over 100 years ago. And think about the way that this chapter of history that they helped to write has impacted and influenced the histories of our two nations. But remember too that Australia and Aotearoa New Zealand are more than just the oft-invoked Anzac spirit, and that what it is to be an Aussie, what it is to be a Kiwi, was not solely and irreversibly defined a century ago during the ill-fated Gallipoli campaign. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of the Gallipoli campaign and the role that the Anzacs played in it. And I do hope you got something out of this episode. I certainly learned a lot researching it. And with the invariable culture wars that spring up around many of Australia's public holidays, I think it's important to consider some of the wider implications of what we celebrate and take note of the way that some enterprising political opportunists will use these celebrations as a way to build and support their own exclusionary narratives. Anyway, a very quick, boring housekeeping outro here because this was a long episode. Halfasthistory.net, of course, is the website. I would love to hear what you thought of this episode, or indeed if you've got other topic suggestions for future episodes, please let me know. Use the contact form there at halfasthistory.net. I want to thank everyone who has been supporting the show on social media by liking, commenting, and subscribing. Do head over to TikTok or Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or X, whatever platform you choose. And be sure to follow the show. Leave those Give This Man a Book Deal comments. They are coming through thick and fast, and I still very much love to see it. And if you want to support the show in a more material way, you can, of course, jump over to Patreon, patreon.com/halfasshistory. Gain access to all sorts of special secret behind-the-scenes stuff, show notes, uncut episodes, early access to episodes as well, and, of course, ad-free listening available there. But thank you one and all to each and every listener who is tuning in each week, whether you're a new listener or an old listener. It is great to have you along. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell people about whom you feel largely ambivalent, particularly at a time like this with Anzac Day in the public consciousness. It might be a good time to send this episode to a friend or an enemy or someone about whom you feel largely ambivalent, so they too can learn a little bit more about this national holiday that we're celebrating across both our nations at the moment, both in Australia and over across the Tasman in Aotearoa. And to all the Kiwis listening as well, I do apologise that this episode did have, particularly towards the end, a little bit of an Australian slant to it. It's not because I forgot about you Kiwis. It's because I don't really have much of an experience of what Anzac Day is like in Aotearoa. So I do hope you realize that it's not out of neglect. It's just because I don't want to speak from ignorance. So it would be interesting to learn, to hear from any Kiwi listeners about your perspectives, particularly on Anzac Day and our nation's shared histories. So so do get in touch if you feel like sharing your thoughts. I'd love to hear from you. Anyway, going to close out the show, of course. What if I feel like I forgot? Oh, merch. Merch. Yes, of course, merch. Over at the print bar. You can go to, head to the website, halfhousehistory.net. There's a link there. I think it's halfhousehistory.theprintbar.com. And you can gain access to t-shirts and what else have I got there? Stubby holders as well. And mugs. I think there are mugs. Go and have a look at that if you fancy picking something up, particularly if you're in Australia or New Zealand where the shipping is a little cheaper. Do allow a little bit of time for delivery. I've had some feedback from people saying that it does take a little bit longer than they might have expected for the items to arrive. But let me know your experience with the print bar. So far, the feedback has been mostly positive, apart from the shipping time. So that's that. Anyway, all right, closing out the show, as ever, with a question posed on Reddit. See you back here next week for more Half-Assed History. Until then, leaving you with a question posed by Redditor or the Trombone Geek, who asks, why was the First World War called the War to End All Wars? Shouldn't the fact that it was called the First World War have tipped them off that there was going to be another one?
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.